I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today we're going to be talking about one of the most important documents in American history, one that was incredibly meaningful in its time, but I think its importance has only grown over the decades and even the century. For what it says about America and what lessons we can draw from it today, particularly on the heels of an incredibly important presidential election. That document, of course, is Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural address, given on March 4th, 1865. And I'm joined for the conversation today about that with one of my closest friends, personally and professionally, and a person who listeners of this podcast probably needs no introduction to them. But just in case you just fell off the turnip truck, it's Professor Jason Stevens. Jason teaches political science at Ashland University. He also teaches and works in Ashbrook's programs for students, for teachers, and for citizens. The whole range, really, of civic education Jason has been involved with in one form or another for a number of years now. Jason is an outstanding scholar of Abraham Lincoln and an absolutely terrific teacher of Abraham Lincoln. And maybe most important, a great student of Lincoln. So we're delighted to have Jason Stevens with us today on The American Idea.
Jeff, thanks so much for having me back. I'm happy to be here.
Jason, I think everyone's heard of Lincoln's second inaugural address. But, and our, as you know, our listeners are pretty historically informed, but probably we don't all know what the context of the speech is. It's given, as I said, on March 4th, 1865. What's happening in the Civil War at that time?
Yeah, great question. So the second inaugural, there are many interesting and unique things about it. One unique thing is that there hadn't been a second inaugural for 30-some years since Jackson. So Lincoln is in this unique position of being reelected and now delivering a second inaugural address to the nation. We probably know that it's one of the shortest inaugural addresses. In fact, I think only George Washington's second and FDR's fourth inaugural address rank as shorter in length. The context, the historical context for the speech, of course, it's the second inaugural, so it follows the first inaugural that he had given 4 years earlier, March 4th, 1861. Lincoln, of course, has just been reelected in November of 1864, which was very significant. He had run on a platform of his slogan was, don't change horses in the middle of the stream, which perhaps is not the most eloquent or catchy campaign slogan.
But it gets right to the heart of the matter.
It does.
Because what was the presidential election of 1864 like? What was that election like, and what did Lincoln think was going to happen?
Yeah, so Lincoln is running against his Democratic opponent, George McClellan, former Union general of the Army of the Potomac, somebody who Lincoln had tried to work with, because of McClellan's overcautiousness, we'll call it, Lincoln had dismissed him twice, actually. McClellan runs against Lincoln in the election of 1864 as a peace Democrat, as what was known as a copperhead, trying to secure immediate peace as soon as possible, even if that meant breaking up the Union or re-enslaving freed African Americans. That's McClellan is Lincoln's Democratic opponent. And Lincoln, even rather late into the race, as late as the end of August of 1864, Lincoln was sure that he was going to lose the election. He writes at one point that it seems increasingly likely that this administration will not be reelected, and then it will be my duty to work with the president-elect between his election and his inauguration in order to save the union, since he will have secured his election on grounds that will make it impossible to save it after his inauguration. So Lincoln was convinced he was going to lose, and lose badly. But what ended up happening was very much the reverse. It's a resounding victory for Lincoln. He trounces McClellan in the Electoral College. It's something like 212-21 in the Electoral College, so it's not even close. Lincoln receives 55% of the popular vote, right? Even though, of course, 11 states are not, the 11 so-called seceded states are not voting in the election. So, right, resoundingly reelected in 1864. And at the same time that Lincoln is delivering this speech, right, the following March of 1865, the war seems to be coming to an end, right? Of course, we, in retrospect, we can say, oh, well, it's March of 1865. Lee surrenders to Grant's, right, April 9th, 1865. So it's about a month left in the war. Of course, nobody then knows that. But everybody north and south sees where, like, they know where the wind is blowing. This is going to end eventually in a Union victory, hopefully sooner rather than later. And as a result of that progress, right, in the field, there are many in the North who are crying out for revenge against the South for bringing on this terrible civil war, especially the abolitionists in the North, right, really wanted their pound of flesh. They wanted, whenever the war ends, right, they wanted the South to be punished for starting the Civil War, which had cost so much blood and treasure, right, over the course of the past 4 years or so. And right, so Lincoln faces this situation where he's been resoundingly reelected. The war seems to be coming to an end, and many who support him are crying out, right, for revenge against those who have started it.
So in the context of, if, for example, the radical Republicans, Charles Sumner, Thaddeus Stevens, and among others who say, are saying now it's time to really go after the South. I suspect that this inaugural surprised a lot of people, not only because of how brief it was, but because if I am the president at this time, and certainly the president's allies, like you describe, probably many people are thinking, okay, what are we going to do with the South when the war is over? They're already starting to think about reconstruction or revenge or whatever post-war situation they face. And what they know is morally we're right. We're militarily, we've won, and politically, now it's time to dominate them. What does Lincoln say in the second inaugural?
Yeah, what he says is not what you would expect, right? Given those circumstances that we talked about, what you might expect is for Lincoln to talk about himself, to talk about all that he has accomplished, right? After all, he is just one re-election when nobody, including Lincoln, thought he would win. He stands at the head of this victorious, conquering Union army that seems right within grasp of right total victory. So you would expect Lincoln to run a victory lap here. You would expect him to talk a lot about himself and what he has accomplished. You would expect a lot of I, me, look at all that I have done. And he may very well right be justified in doing so. But I think he surprises his audience because he almost completely removes himself out of the speech. Lincoln doesn't talk about himself, especially right in this opportunity where you would really expect that to happen. There's one or two passing references to I or myself that he uses in the first paragraph. But other than that, it's very abstract. It also is somewhat tortured in tone. Lincoln, instead of focusing on himself, he focuses on the Union as a whole. The most frequently used word in the second inaugural, for example, is the word all. All appears 10 times and is the most, by far the most frequently used word in the speech. Lincoln is attempting to reconcile the country after this momentous civil war. The speech, it doesn't vilify, right? There's no gloating. Lincoln is trying to bring about a reconciliation or a re-inauguration of the national authority or reconstruction or whatever you want to call it. But that reconciliation, from Lincoln's point of view, also requires understanding what the war was about, why it was fought, and what we can learn about ourselves and America.
Presumably, from that struggle. The triumphant North would say, well, we know what it was about. It was about slavery in the South. It was about the unwillingness to bend on any issue of the slave power, as they called it. Who caused it? The Southerners with their crazy secession ideas. And now it's time to, as you say, get our pound of flesh and let them have it. That was probably a pretty widespread opinion, especially since Lincoln is reelected and people are not standing for peace with the South. But they want victory, apparently. Is that what Lincoln says in the second inaugural?
Yeah, so... As you mentioned, right, there are those in the North, especially the abolitionists, who, because victory seems to be within our grasp, that is affirmation that the North is right, the South is wrong, that God is on our side. Right. Lincoln takes a bit more nuanced approach here, right? He does recognize that there is a difference between North and South. But that difference, instead of being amplified, is subtle. So for instance, he does, right, say this one point, at one point he says, right, we all have a lot in common. We both read the same Bible. We both pray to the same God. Each invokes his aid against the other. So again, there seems to be a lot in common. But then he says, but it might seem strange that any men should dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces. That's the closest Lincoln comes to blaming the South or putting blame upon the South, because he's recognizing that it's somewhat strange, right, that these Southerners would be praying or would dare to pray to a just God for his assistance in order to perpetuate slavery, right, which is an attempt. Here he's quoting, I think this is his first biblical quotation. There are four in the speech. This is the first one to Genesis 3:19. And it references the divine punishment, right, to human beings that, right, from if you want to eat, you're going to have to work, right? By the sweat of your brow will you earn your bread. Lincoln is recognizing slavery is an attempt to get around that divine punishment. And so it's strange that the Southerners would dare to ask a just God to continue slavery. But then immediately Lincoln follows that up with, well, let us judge not that we be not judged. Now there's this New Testament quotation from Matthew 7:1. So he comes right up to the line of like blaming the South and saying, look, you guys are acting unjustly. But then his response is, well, let us judge not that we be not judged. And I think he's directing that remark especially to the abolitionist, like the Thaddeus Stevenses, the Charles Sumners in the audience, as you mentioned, right, who are saying, like, judge not that we be not judged. What are you talking about, Lincoln? Right? They're in the wrong. We were in the right. We know slavery is wrong. What do you mean, judge not? No, we need to judge, and judgment needs to come down upon the South, and they need to be punished for what they have done. I think Lincoln is setting up here, again, a more nuanced way of understanding what the Civil War was about. It wasn't about slavery in the South. It wasn't Southern slavery. It wasn't Confederate slavery that was the cause of the war. As he says in that third paragraph, it was American slavery. We have all somehow participated in one way or another in the sin of American slavery. And he thinks about the Civil War possibly as a punishment from a just God to both North and South for the terrible sin of American slavery.
Before we continue with our discussion, I'd like to let you know about an outstanding set of programs that Ashbrook sponsors for high school students, the Ashbrook Academy.
Do you know any students with an interest in American history, politics, economics, and literature? Do they enjoy being academically challenged and the thrill of engaging with different ideas and viewpoints? Hi, I'm Sabrina Maristella, Student Programs Coordinator here at the Ashbrook Center. The Ashbrook Academy is a series of summer courses for rising high school juniors and seniors. Held in person at Ashland University, the Academy immerses you in the American story like you've never been before. Since 2015, our approach has taken history out of textbooks and into students' lives with historical documents and conversations about those documents. If you are a rising high school junior or senior, or if you know someone who is, we invite you to learn more about our courses and apply today at ashbrookacademy.org.
That's a really interesting idea because the second inaugural has five paragraphs by my count. And the first paragraph does, as you said, basically say, look, I'm not going to give you the kind of speech I gave you in my first inaugural, which is long and detailed and kind of a legal argument about and against secession. I'm going to talk to you about something different. I'm not going to give a report on our military situation because he says, I trust that is well known and reasonably encouraging and satisfactory. And then in the second paragraph, he really says, almost as you were saying, I'll give us a kind of history of the war. How did the war happen? What caused it? And it's so interesting there, as you said, he doesn't say that the Southerners caused it. He says there are both parties deprecated war, but one of them would make war rather than let the nation survive, and the other would accept war rather than let it perish. And the war came. It's passive,
yeah,
that phrase. So almost not to quite blame fully one side or the other, the war just came. And as you suggest in the third paragraph, he seems to be saying, yeah, and the war came perhaps as a punishment from a just God on the whole nation for the sin of slavery. That's quite a remarkable statement to make as a president. And it seems like it would have been disappointing and infuriating to a lot of people.
Yes, and I think in a way it was, especially again to those abolitionists in the audience. Lincoln he corresponds with a friend of his, a man by the name of Thurlow Weed, a New York politician. After the speech, Weed writes him a congratulatory letter saying, "Like, I really liked your second inaugural." Lincoln says, "You know, thank you," This is what Lincoln says. He says, I expect it to wear as well as, perhaps better than anything else I have ever produced. But I believe that right now it is not immediately popular because human beings are not flattered by being shown that there has been a difference of purpose between them and the Almighty. Right? That God was trying to, I don't want to say, right, it's not about like teaching America a lesson for the sin of slavery, but there were, God was at work in the Civil War. Lincoln goes through this speech really trying to understand the meaning behind the Civil War. He starts off by trying to find the meaning of the war in human actions. Like human beings, we have, right, have tried to control events, but we have failed, right? We have, right, neither, he says, right, neither anticipated that the cause of the conflict might cease with or even before the cause of the conflict should cease, right? So we've gotten rid of the cause of the conflict, slavery, Emancipation Proclamation, the 13th Amendment at this point hasn't been ratified, but it's been passed by Congress. It's been sent out to the states for ratification. So we've gotten rid of the cause of slavery. I'm sorry, the cause of the war. And yet the war continues. That's strange. Human beings have tried to control events through their own actions, but seemingly have failed because the war drags on. So maybe the meaning of the war isn't to be found in human action. Maybe the meaning of the war can be found in man's prayers. So he says, right, both read the same Bible, pray to the same God, invoking his aid against the other, but the war still continues. Lincoln then, in that third and longest paragraph, turns to examining perhaps the possibility that the meaning, the significance of the war, it's not to be found in human beings and what we're trying to accomplish, how we try to control events, but in God's will, that God is up to something behind, right, everything that's going on in the Civil War, to provide a just punishment for North and South for the horrible sin of American slavery. After all, one person died in the war for every 7 who had been enslaved from 1619 to 1865.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing. And I guess it is 4 paragraphs. I may have said 5, but I think it's 4, as you were suggesting, the long third one. And it's interesting because in that long third one, he says, very famously, "Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away," which is, of course, is what a lot of people wanted who voted for McClellan, right? We want peace. We would rather have peace than anything else. We'd rather have peace than the abolition of slavery. That issue is decided. He says, we want the scourge of war to pass away. But then there's this line, and I wonder what you make of this. He said, "Yet if God wills that the war continue until all the wealth piled by the bondsman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, as it was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether." It sounds like he's saying, okay, if the war continues, so be it. That's the judgment of God in recompense for the violence and plundering of slavery.
Yeah, that's the third quotation from, I'm not sorry, that's the fourth and final quotation from the Bible. Another Old Testament one, Psalm 19:9, "The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether." So, right, if Lincoln's right, notice, right, it's a conditional statement, right? It begins with if God wills that it continue, right? Until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, right? If this war continues for, right, another 250 years, if that happens, what must we say? "The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether." In other words, we deserve it. Not the South, we, the North and the South, that we have both shared in this terrible sin of American slavery. Sure, there was no slavery in the North, right? But certainly economically, the North had benefited, right? Their cotton shirts, for instance. Everybody had benefited from slavery, even if they had never owned slaves. Lincoln is playing with that idea, that possibility. If he's right, if he, Lincoln, is right, and he's just playing with this idea, he's putting it out there, right, for others to chew on. If there is more going on in this war than what, right, human beings think is going on, like if God is behind this, then that means even if this war continues for 250 years, slavery is such an evil, such a horrible thing that we must, at the end of the day, say we deserve it, because that's what justice would require. The third paragraph is about justice. And that justice, that idea of justice, Lincoln plays with and says, maybe the Civil War is God's divine justice working itself out to both North and South, which then is why in the fourth paragraph, if, again, Lincoln's hypothesis is right, that the Civil War is a divine punishment from a just God, now the fourth paragraph and the final paragraph turns to the topic of forgiveness, charity, reconciliation that can come after justice has been satisfied.
Can I read that famous last paragraph? Because I just think the words are so amazing. And I really want your thoughts on this and what it means for today. It says, "With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, and as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations."
Yeah, that is probably the most famous closing to a inaugural address that I can think of. The only one that competes with that is the closing Lincoln gives in his first inaugural, which touches upon similar themes, right? The appeal to the better angels of our nature in order to avoid civil war. We didn't listen in 1861 to Lincoln's appeal to the better angels of our nature. Here, right, he encourages malice towards none, with charity for all, However, some might say, what are you talking about, Mr. Lincoln? Wouldn't it be better to say, I don't know, with malice towards some, with charity for most? Why malice towards none with charity for all? Aren't you ignoring justice? Right? But if Lincoln's right in what he says in the third paragraph about divine justice, then once this war is over with, God has taken care of justice. Then it becomes the work of human beings to see to forgiveness, charity, reconciliation. If the claims of Lincoln in the third paragraph are not true, then his attempt at reconciliation and forgiveness in the fourth paragraph would ignore justice, would ignore the requirements of justice. But if Lincoln is right in what he says in the third paragraph, then the fourth paragraph follows, because once justice has been satisfied, now we human beings can turn to the work of forgiveness, of reconciliation, to charity, in the attempt to heal a divided nation.
It's an amazing, deep philosophical speech, beautifully moving poetry. Clearly inspiring, and has inspired a lot of people over since it was given in 1865. What do you take away from this speech? Lessons for us to think about, insights for us to think about as we face and have faced a very a divided country and a very difficult and contested presidential election.
Yeah, very good question. So after Lincoln delivers this speech, right, he goes out into the crowd, he starts shaking hands, and he runs into Frederick Douglass, the former slave, the renowned orator, the abolitionist. Lincoln sees Fred Douglass, and Lincoln goes up to him, and he sort of claps him on the shoulder and says, "There's my friend, Fred Douglass. Mr. Douglass, what did you think of my little speech?" And Frederick Douglass responds, "Mr. President, it was a sacred effort." In fact, Douglass later wrote that it sounded more like a sermon than a state paper. I would say a couple of things in answer to your question, Jeff. One, every time I read this speech, I'm always astounded, not just by Lincoln's rhetoric, but by his humility. Again, there is no I, there is no me in this speech. I think in the modern day, we have become so jaded by the political rhetoric that, right, regardless, Republican or Democrat, it's me, 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 my, I don't think this is a speech, you know, the second inaugural address. This is not a speech that Donald Trump or Kamala Harris would be capable of delivering. So in a way, it reminds me that Lincoln, in his understanding of America, in his representation of America, if you want to understand America, one must come to understand Abraham Lincoln, and that he represents the best of America, and that best of America is still possible. Even in our modern day, when we are, right, doing all the I, me, 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 and the political missives that we, rhetorical missives that we hurl back and forth to each other, sometimes that rhetoric can get really bad, and we can find solace in Lincoln and his language. But also, I'm reminded that despite, right, the rhetoric, despite the divisiveness in modern politics, that is still a product of reflection and choice. To borrow a Hamiltonian phrase from the Federalist, we're still talking to each other. When I read Lincoln, when I look at the second inaugural, right, things, when you study American history, you come to realize, you know what, as a country, we have survived a lot. We have come through a great civil war, stronger for it. Today, yeah, there's a lot of divisiveness, but you know what, we've been through worse. Look at the Civil War, right? We're not talking to each other. We resort to killing each other at this time. Even today, with all of the divisive language, we should be reminded that, right, we Americans, we have faced a lot of challenges, and we've always come out of it stronger and better, and we'll come out of this one stronger and better as well.
Mm. And it does seem to me that Lincoln's statesmanship invites a kind of, as you said, humility, a kind of moderation. And I think, am I right to say, a kind of recognition that whatever political differences we have, as Americans, we're bound by certain fundamental principles that, of course, Lincoln himself always traced back to our founding, in particular, the Declaration of Independence, where he said, look, we really are, to echo Thomas Jefferson, brethren of the same principle, despite the political differences and contests that come out every 4 years in presidential elections. Is that part of Lincoln's confidence, his ability to be moderate and humble, because he believes deep down we really can keep talking because we do, in our heart of hearts, share certain fundamental principles?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, Lincoln always went back to that old Declaration of Independence, right, the home of what he called my ancient faith. And the principles of self-government contained therein. Lincoln, like the founders, always believed that human beings not only should govern themselves, but they can govern themselves under law. That, as the founders had said in the 39th Federalist, as James Madison had said, we rest all of our political experiments on the capacity of mankind for self-government. The founders had confidence that human beings could govern themselves, and so did Lincoln. But Lincoln had to remind his generation of those principles of self-government that we all share in common as human beings, as Americans. And I think that every generation of Americans needs to be reminded of those principles as well, because those principles of freedom, they don't pass down through the generations through the bloodstream, but they actually have to be taught. And I know of no greater teacher of the principles of self-government, the principles of liberty and freedom, than Abraham Lincoln.
That's such an important reminder for all of us to resort to after this election, to remind ourselves of the principles that we share as Americans, and to look to Lincoln for insight and inspiration. And to you, Jason, my thanks for helping us unpack that and see that insight and inspiration in Lincoln's second inaugural. Jason Stevens, as always, thank you for joining us on The American Idea.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.